national call for moral revival, and the head of repairs of the breach. And I'm going to have him offer some thoughts about the theme for this week and a moral framing. And then we have an excellent set of educators here tonight. So please, please welcome Bishop Barber.
Thank you, Colleen. I'm glad to welcome everybody and the thousands of you across the nation who are joining us tonight in more than 40 states and watch parties across. This is not just teaching for the purpose of being educated, but this is teaching for the purpose of being empowered so that we can be informed activists, so that we can engage. We decided early on that if we were going to engage in 40 days of nonviolent moral fusion, civil disobedience, and massive voter mobilization, that it had to be rooted in truth. It had to be both empirical data and anecdotal data. In other words, it had to be with footnotes and it had to be with faces of real people. Because one of the worst things you can do is be loud and wrong. And so we don't want a movement that is loud and wrong. We want a movement that is loud for the right reasons. As Dr. King said, we want to be clear that we have legitimate discontent. As Sister Lucy will sing and help you with in a moment, we want to be clear why the world needs to be changed and why we are the ones to engage in that changing, and that we are the ones indeed that we've been looking for. So every Tuesday night, we teach why yesterday hundreds of people across this nation were arrested, and why they were in talking about systemic racism, particularly through the lens of voter suppression. Why were they talking about systemic racism and talking about it in a way not just in terms of personal relationship, but in terms of systemic policies? Why are we 2 weeks into this and nearly 2,000 people across this nation have been willing to risk arrest and be arrested? Why are there actions happening in 40 states and the District of Columbia? Why have black and white and brown and red and yellow and Jewish and Christian and Muslim and Hindu and Sikh and people not of faith but who believe in the deep moral traditions of either our Constitution or their own philosophical traditions? Why have gay and straight? Why have people in the South and in the North and in the West and in the East come together for the 40-day launching of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for a moral revival? Why are people calling for a political Pentecost, a change in this country? Why are we challenging Democrats and Republicans? Why are we challenging those who obstruct, but also those who are often reluctant to really deal with the issues? Why are we saying that we can no longer have a conversation politically in this country or an agenda that talks about the middle class and the military but never says a word about the poor? Why are we saying something is wrong when you have 26 presidential election debates on both sides of the aisle and not 1 hour on the Voting Rights Act and voter suppression? Why? In a democracy. Why is it that we're saying we won't be silent anymore? Why is it that we're saying that while the Russia is the headline, even before Russia, the headlines ought to be how voter suppression hacked our system? This is about teaching that is deepening our understanding, deepening impacted communities. And why are we having live stream? Well, 50 years ago, when the Poor People's Campaign was in Washington, D.C., they had this kind of teaching every night. Right. A lot of people don't know, though, 50 years ago, they were able to get a two-week permit to put up the shanties. Today, you can't even get a permit. You can't even get a permit. Now, they overstayed their permit by 4 weeks, but we haven't even been able to overstay because we can't even get a permit because the law is now such that they don't even allow you to stay on federal ground. So how do poor people lobby? They can't pay $500 a night, $300 a night for rooms. So basically, we have an impoverished democracy that has literally locked the poor out. And you don't even hear the word poor in the political discussion. You don't even hear the word poor from the floor of the Congress. And when it's mentioned sometimes slightly by, for instance, Republicans, they blame the poor as though the poor have some morality problem, personal morality. When Democrats dare to say it just a little bit, they quickly move back to talking about the middle class and some neoliberal argument that somehow if you just talk about poverty and, income and you don't deal with issues like race, that somehow you can solve the issue in America. But we know in America there can be no transformation in our society if you don't deal with systemic racism and systemic poverty together. In fact, Dr. King said three things: militarism, poverty, right? And racism. We say today there are five interlocking injustices. Five: systemic racism, systemic poverty, ecological devastation, the war economy and militarism, and the false narrative, moral narrative, of religious nationalism that basically says if you just care, if you're just against gay people, and against abortion, and for prayer in the school, and for tax cuts for the wealthy, and for gun rights, somehow you're on the right side, the God side of issues, and you don't have to say anything about poverty and racism. Those are five interlocking injustices that do not just threaten the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, they threaten the very heart of our democracy. And that is why people all over the country are coming together. Tonight, our focus is on the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for a moral revival, systemic racism and voter suppression, and how there is a direct line from systemic racism as seen through voter suppression to unjust political majorities, poverty, immigration injustice, school resegregation, mistreatment of indigenous communities, mass incarceration, xenophobia, and Islamophobia. And I'm going to say to the audience, even though we're live streaming, y'all can get loud and draw a cloud in here. Y'all can say something. That what we have found is that wherever there's voter suppression, and since before Trump, we've got to help people get we've got to help people get over their addiction to Trump so they can really have a deep analysis of how Trump came to be. And before Trump was even running for office, since 2010, 23 states have passed voter suppression laws. And you can map, we've actually done it, you can map where every state that has massive voter suppression laws has also had bad race-driven gerrymandering laws, which has allowed people to get elected to state legislatures and the United States Congress in ways which mean we have state legislatures, and right now in some ways the United States Congress, particularly in the House, that is unconstitutionally constituted. Because there are people sitting in those offices that would not be there if it wasn't for voter suppression.
That's right.
And gerrymandering.
That's right. That's right.
Once you see that, we then find out, and here is the strange irony, that people, when we look at it empirically, the people who then vote, who then benefit from racist voter suppression and racial gerrymandering that's targeted toward black people and brown people, once they get into office, they end up passing laws that hurt mostly poor white people. And we have to expose that trickery.
That's right.
To our white brothers and sisters. I don't blame them that they are, that people are going out and telling them lies and getting their votes, telling them that voting, they need to have photo ID law to protect voting, and they're trying to protect the franchise when what they're trying to do is unravel the franchise. And then when they get elected, they end up blocking living wages. They block anti-poverty programs. They pass the worst laws against gay people and the worst laws against our immigrant brothers and sisters, and they defund public education, and they support policies that resegregate our schools, and they block health care, and they pass laws that create more mass incarceration. But it all begins with massive voter suppression. And here we are at a time when we have less voting rights than we had 53 years ago, and it's not even being discussed in the headlines. That's why we have to have a movement to demand and understand the intersectionality of these issues. And so that's why we're here tonight. That's why we have this tremendous panel led by Penda Hare tonight, who she will introduce in a moment, because these are movement folk. They don't just do this just to stay in offices. We have a panel tonight that informs us how to fight. Yeah. The sister team. They like super sisters. You know, I got on the phone and called every one of them. I said, I know all of y'all, and I've been doing that. I said, I called every one of them. I said, we need you. We need you, just like ancient Israel needed Deborah. You know, Deborah was a sister. She had the ministry of agitation. That was her whole ministry. And when the people didn't want to fight injustice, Deborah would say, you better get up. And she had a husband named Liptoff. I think that was his name. And his name meant fire, but he wasn't even a smolder. He had gotten scared. And Deborah went over and said, you better get up from here and fight. You know, the Lord didn't put you here to be the beneficiary of 350 years of other folks fighting, and then you get the rest. You know, if we don't fight to stop voter suppression and make the connection and understand why voter suppression can't be just a black issue where black people work on it. Just like racism can't be a black issue. I mean, it's targeted at black people and brown people, but racism is really a target at democracy. A white nationalists don't just hate black people, they hate democracy. And we can't just talk about racism when it's Charlottesville and then after that it's over. As bad as that was, and horrific as it was, we can't just talk about racism when somebody calls you the N-word, because most people have gotten smart enough not to do that. What we have to talk about, and I'm going to just say it plain because I'm trying to stir up some, we have to talk about the niggerization of policies. Woo! We have to talk about policy violence. We have to talk about when people stand up and never say the N-word, but they're passing policies. And when they pass those policies to suppress the vote, at the same time they're going after my white sister. Right? And that's the fusion. Dr. King said at the end of the Selma to Montgomery March, he said that in American history, there is a white aristocracy that's formed in racism that has always at every turn done everything they could to stop black, brown, white alliances.
Right. That's right.
And every time you see the policies of voter suppression coming out all over the country, it means that the extremists, the aristocracy, sees the possibility of black, white, brown alliance, and they start trying to cut it off.
That's right.
After the Shelby decision 2013, we've seen massive voter suppression, and Barbara and Penda tell you all about that. I'm not going to talk about what that decision meant and what it means now. And the fact that we should be saying, you know, we're getting ready to go into a third election without the full protection of the Voting Rights Act. And then there are some people say, well, you can just overcome that with massive registration. No, you can't. You have to have both. It's not either or. It's both and. So I'm glad that Liz Theo Harris, our co-chair, is here. And that's why tonight is so important. So let me do this real quickly. Three T's I want to lift up to frame. Because my point tonight is to frame this conversation for the audience online and in here. First of all, why are we talking so much about voter suppression and talking about it as a moral issue? Theologically, that's the first T. The first and greatest sin, whether it's in Judaism, Christianity, or Islam, and almost in almost all faith tradition, is the sin of idolatry. That's the greatest sin of any religious tradition. It is to play God, worship self, worship your kind above other kinds, the sin of idolatry. In the Christian, Judeo-Christian story of creation, whether you believe it as a story or a matter of faith, it says that when God created everything, God created male and female, he created them. But there's a word that in the image, in the imago Dei, not as God, but in the image of God. Right? Now, idolatry is when one attempts to supersede God and believe that you can dismiss the image of God in other people. So before voter suppression, Jonathan, is a political issue. It's a theological issue. Voter suppression is sin before it's just simply bad policy. The reason being because the image of God, the image, the full image of God, the full image of the divine, the creator, is only seen as being given to human beings. Uh-huh. Right? That's why we don't give voting rights to parakeets, puppies, and other pets. There's no provision in the Constitution to give voting rights to parakeets, puppies, and pets. We only give voting rights to those who are 18, born or naturalized in these United States. They have to be a human being, born or naturalized in these United States. Therefore, logic says, if I suppress the vote of anyone born or naturalized in these United States that's 18, I'm suggesting they're not human. See, to suppress the vote is to question the humanity of someone else. It is to elevate yourself to the position of God and say, I can deny you what I said every person, 18 born or naturalized in these United States, could have. So if I suppress your vote, I'm suggesting you are either not 18 born or naturalized in these United States, or you are 18 born and naturalized in these United States, but you have a subhumanity. That's idolatry. It's a theological problem. It's a sin problem. And any politician, you can tell them I said it, that is going around suppressing the vote, they are engaging in idolatry. Clearing at the end of the story. Now, the second T I want to suggest is timeline. There are at least two major timelines in history in America. There are many more. But one timeline is the line immediately after slavery, after the end of slavery, called the Reconstruction. And in 1863, before the Civil War was over, we got the 13th Amendment. But right after the war was over, in 1868 and 1872, we got two amendments. And without these three amendments, the Constitution was really a flawed document. And in fact, I get so bothered by folks saying the most important amendment is the Second Amendment. The most important amendments are the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. And then, of course, the 26th Amendment about women. But let's deal with the first one. The 14th was equal protection under the law as a non-negotiable. Because these are the laws that these lawyers use whenever they're fighting voter suppression. You cannot deny anybody equal protection under the law. The Third Amendment was the voting amendment, 15th Amendment, that no government, nobody has the right, watch this, to deny. But they didn't just say deny. They said and or abridge. And I like to simply say, Penda, I'm not a lawyer, I play one on Tuesday, that a bridge means you can't take the bridge. In other words, you can't remove what gets me over there. And by 1872 in the South, every state legislature, once voting was open to black men and white men, no, it still wasn't women, but all black men and white men registered, born and naturalized 18, when voting was open, in less than 7 years after slavery, every Southern legislature was controlled by a black caucus. It was controlled by a black-white fusion caucus. And the first attack to undermine that was the attack on voting rights. I said the second point is timeline. Anytime you see a coordinated, conscientious, collective attack on voter suppression, somebody has looked at the demographics and said, we can't afford to allow this to be this open, because if these poor whites and poor blacks and poor brown folk get together, they're going to take over. That's really what's behind immigrant injustice. It's not that they don't want the immigrants here, they just don't want to be able to vote. They want them here to work and pay taxes but not vote. Because if they connect with black and white and brown people, that changes the demographic, and especially in the South. Say timeline. Now, the second timeline is when Dr. King was being killed, was killed, and the Poor People's Campaign was starting, but this movement was being assassinated. Right as Dr. King was being destroyed and the movement was being shot, another movement was rising called the Southern Strategy.
Right.
1968, Kevin Phillips told Richard Nixon two things. This is how we can win forever. No, this is how we can win for 50 years. And this is the 50th year. See, if you know this history, you know Donald Trump was playing for 50 years ago. A candidate like him. He benefited from a culture that was cultivated for 50 years. 50 years ago, they said, here's how we win in America. Number one, we have to first make sure we lock up the South. 171 electoral votes in the 13 former Confederate states. How do we do that? We have to turn black and poor white people against one another. That's the first thing we have to do. Second, we have to suppress the vote. We cannot allow the 1965 Voting Rights Act to be used without challenging it. And no state in the South ever had a period of 10 years where they stopped discriminating. If they had, they could have opted out of the Voting Rights Act pre-clearance. They couldn't resist, because voter suppression in this historical timeline is always the first move to block the possibility of reconstructing the American society. And reconstruction from 1954 to 1968 had changed America, and people were sick of the change, and so the first thing they chose was division and suppression of the right to vote. Could it be that the reason we're seeing so much suppression, and we've seen so much, Barbara, for the last 10 years, is that we're in the middle of a third reconstruction. And people are simply trying to block it from coming to its full fruition. In other words, the very people that claim they don't believe in abortion, they are trying to abort a third reconstruction. Now here's the last point. Theology, timeline, turnaround. Turnaround. These sisters are going to show you tonight across the nation why right now we have the power to turn it around.
That's right.
Even this Supreme Court is having to agree that some of this stuff is surgical racism, which is amazing. But right now in the South particularly, and in some parts of the Midwest and the Wheat Belt and the Rust Belt, if you register 30% of the African-American vote and they connect with progressive whites and progressive black, Alabama doesn't have to be an anomaly. There are 4 or 5 states in the South right now. You could flip if you protect, if you restore voting rights, block voter suppression, and at the same time engage in massive voter mobilization. You could flip North Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Texas, and probably Alabama. And some people think Georgia, and maybe Mississippi. And if you do that, the whole country politics has been changed. And we are then fully in the midst of a third Reconstruction. This is not the time to whine. This is the time to fight and the time to be organized, because the very tactics that the extremists are using, Penda, is proof of our strength. People don't cheat you if they can beat you in a straight up fight. You need to hear what I just said. Y'all didn't get that. Sometimes your enemy is actually proving your strength. You didn't hear what I'm saying. If folk have to suppress the right to vote, come up with photo IDs, block students on campuses, create racist gerrymandering, put $10 billion into this elections, as John Nichols called, trying to make it a dollarocracy rather than a democracy, and then go all the way to Russia and Saudi Arabia to get help to win. They are not doing that because they're strong. They're doing that because they're weak, and they are hoping that we don't figure out just how strong we are. They are hoping that black people will stay over here and deal with racism, and white people will get over here and deal with environment and economics. And they do not want us to have a fusion movement where we all come together and we understand that voter suppression is an attack on all of us. But guess what? In the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for a moral revival. Did y'all see Nick yesterday at the rally? Right. Nick from Appalachia, who said, I was taught all my life that black people were the reason for my problem, but I found out that was a lie. And he said there are white people up in Appalachia that are ready to organize. And there are black people down in Alabama that are ready to organize. And if we get black people from Alabama and white people from Appalachia, and they all start understanding their power, oh, what a day it's going to be in America, Lucy. We're going to change the world. That is why it is important that you hear this teaching tonight. That is why I wanted to set the theological, the time, and the turnaround framework tonight, and then turn it over to my counselor who represented me in court, Ms. Penda Hare. And not only did she represent us, but she helped lead the victory against the worst voter suppression law since 2013, really since Jim Crow in North Carolina. And they told some people in the progressive community told us not to fight, but we knew something. We never lost a battle we fight, and the only battles you lose are the ones that you choose not to fight in the first place. Penda Hare is going to lead us tonight.
When we sing together, we breathe together, and our hearts beat together. I'm not here for you to sit back and listen to me. I'm here so that we can sing together. We're going to sing an old tune that many of us know, but we're going to use some words that may be new to some of us. Pronto.
Pronto.
Muy.
Muy.
Pronto.
Pronto.
Cambia.
Cambia.
Cambiaremos,
cambiaremos
este mundo. Pronto, muy pronto, cambiaremos este mundo.
Pronto, muy pronto,
cambiaremos este mundo. Pronto, muy pronto, cambiaremos este mundo. Durará la vida. La vida, cambiaremos este mundo. Soon and very soon, soon and very soon, we are gonna change the world. Well, now, soon and very soon, we are gonna change the world. Well, now, soon and very soon, we are gonna change the world. It's gonna last forever and ever. We're gonna change the world. No more racism. No more racism. We are gonna change the world. No more racism. We are gonna change the world. No more racism. We are gonna change the world. It's gonna last forever and ever. We're gonna change the world. No more sexism. No more sexism. We are gonna change the world. No more sexism. We are gonna change the world. No homophobia. No homophobia. We are gonna change the world. It's gonna last forever and ever. We're gonna change the world soon and very soon. Soon and very soon. We are gonna change the world. Soon and very soon. We are gonna change the world. Soon and very soon. We are gonna change the world. It's gonna last forever.
So we can meet today. The Festival Center is an organization rooted in faith and struggle for the common good. Thank you all for hosting us. My name is Idalyn Bobé, and I serve as an educator for the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. And though I'm part of the education team, today I come here as a student because today is a very important topic. As a poor woman of color, to me, I'm not really big on voting. So when I heard about today's discussion, I thought, this is a very interesting discussion for the Poor People's Campaign to discuss, because as a person who lives in the hood, regardless of who is in the office, a Republican or a Democratic, the hood looks like the hood. So to have these fine women and fine gentlemen and people on stage to really educate us on today's topic, I thought was very powerful. Because although I'm quick to join a direct action, it's really important for me to take time to reflect and understand what is going on today and who is hurting our voice, who is suppressing our people. And today's topic is right on point. So without further ado, I would like to introduce to you all Ms. Panda. Panda Hare is the legal director and co-founder of Forward Justice. For the past 3 years, she has led the legal team for the North Carolina NAACP in a landmark voting rights case, in which the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals found that North Carolina's 2013 voting law was designed with surgical precision intentionally to suppress the vote of African Americans. She is the former director of the Washington, D.C. Office of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund and founder and former co-director of the Advancement Project. Hare is the author of the Rockefeller Foundation's report on innovative civil rights strategies, Louder Than Words, Lawyers, Communities, and the Struggle for Justice. After graduating from Harvard Law School, y'all better give it up to her, she clerked for the U.S. Court of Appeals Judge Wilfred Finberg and U.S. Supreme Court Justice Harry A. Blockman. Panda currently serves as counsel to the Poor People's Campaign National Call for a Moral Revival. It's an honor to have you here with us. Thank you so much.
Good evening. It is a pleasure to be here and to be able to moderate this exciting panel where we are going to consider how systemic racism and voter protection are connected to the Poor People's Campaign, to poverty, to immigration injustice, to school resegregation, to mistreatment of indigenous communities, xenophobia, and Islamophobia. And I'm so glad that Reverend Dr. Barber was able to be our first teacher this evening. Because you need to know where you're going before you figure out your strategies for getting there. And what Reverend Barber gave us tonight is where we're going. He gave us the vision of the third Reconstruction, of the fusion power that we have when we come together. And so I do voting rights. I fight against voter suppression, but I do that because I believe in the power that we have when we have access to the vote, when we have access to the ballot. So before I bring up the first panelist, I just want to say, of all those things that you read on my resume, the thing that I really am so honored to be right now is counsel to this campaign. I want to thank all of the volunteer lawyers around the country in more than 40 states who have stepped forward to provide counsel to the state coordinating committees of this campaign, to defend people when they are arrested and need legal defense, to provide legal observers, and to provide jail support for people while they're in jail, and to watch over for them, and make sure that their needs are cared for while they're in jail. And all of those lawyers, as well as the national legal team, some of whom are here today, have just stepped up because they believe in this campaign. And I'm really proud to be coordinating that legal effort. Well, let me turn now to our panel. We're going to start with Tomas Lopez, who is going to bring us the view from the ground, from the front lines of the voting struggles in maybe the premier state for voting struggles in this country, North Carolina. Tomas is executive director of Democracy North Carolina, and he was previously counsel with the Democracy program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. And as a voting rights attorney there, he litigated about restrictive voting laws and partnered with advocates to advance and defend election reforms at the state level. And prior to joining the Brennan Center, Tomas was a fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center's Immigrant Justice Project, where he successfully helped to challenge anti-immigrant legislation in Alabama. And he previously served as the Bacon Immigration Law and Policy Program Fellow at the University of Arizona and co-authored a report on the impact of Arizona's immigration law on young people. He's a graduate of Duke University and Yale Law School. And without further ado, I will give you the podium to Thomas.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Thank you, Penda, for your introduction. Thank you, fellow panelists, for being here. I apologize for walking in late. I drove up this afternoon from North Carolina, and I had some trouble finding parking.
Excuses.
As you can probably tell from hearing me speak, I'm not from North Carolina. I was born and raised in the Bronx, New York, so I know my way around big cities a bit. But I should say, though, that in not being from North Carolina, I reflect a lot of my fellow residents, because one fact about North Carolina is that it's about half transplants. Another fact about North Carolina is that it's just about the ninth largest state in the Union. Another fact about North Carolina is that it has a long-lasting, substantial African-American population, and from 2000 to 2010, it had the fastest-growing Latinx population in the country. So these are some facts that play into why North Carolina has become such an important place in the struggle for democracy. Now, I'm with an organization called Democracy North Carolina, and we use field organizing, issue advocacy, and policy research to protect the right to vote, fight gerrymandering, reduce the role of big money in our politics, and defend an independent judiciary. The work of democracy, when we talk about access to the polls and the things that are related to it, relate to all these other issues, because if you want to achieve structural reform, ultimately that is going to involve casting a ballot. is ultimately going to involve people running for office. At the same time, we're also really aware that we can't achieve structural reform unless we've actually achieved a multiracial, multi-class civic culture in this country. All right. And that these two things come together, that you can't have one without the other. And so your being here tonight, your watching here tonight, is a piece of that, because it's learning about how these pieces fit together. North Carolina is a telling example of a national story about what has happened in recent years that has affected voting access for literally millions of people. We have dealt with the harsh voting law that Reverend Dr. Barber mentioned. We have dealt with, and people in our state have also fought back.
All right.
So I want to walk us through the key events that have happened since mainly 2010. Now, we're going to hear a bit about Shelby County versus Holder, the Voting Rights Act. I'll leave that to my fellow panelists. But the context that you need to know is that under the old voting rights structure, 40 counties in North Carolina were covered by the Voting Rights Act. And what that meant was that in those 40 counties and in anything that the state did as a whole, before anything could change relating to a voting law, relating to an election-related regulation, that change had to either be cleared by the U.S. Department of Justice or by a federal court. After the Shelby County decision in 2013, that went away. And that meant that the state legislature could pass whatever kind of voting legislation that it wanted without that prophylactic in place. And what they did, mere moments, it seemed like, after the Shelby County decision went down, was the chair of the, I believe it was the State Senate Elections Committee, said, now we can go with the full bill. The full bill. The full version of what they wanted to do to affect voting and access to democracy in the state. Now, since 2010, we've had over 20 states that have, in one way or another, made it more difficult to vote. They have imposed strict photo ID requirements. They have affected the access to early voting. They have changed small rules, like the ability to vote outside of your own precinct if you happen to go there by mistake. In North Carolina, they did all of that and more. So when Reverend Dr. Barber calls H589 the monster voter suppression law, it is because this law took all the bad ideas from other places and rolled them up into one. And over the course of several years, people in North Carolina made a decision. And it was to fight that law, both in courts of law, but also in the courts of public opinion, to make the case that there was actually a moral case against laws like this. Because we know that the kinds of strict photo ID requirements that North Carolina had kept students from voting, kept young people from being a part of this, and affected, in particular, African Americans and other people of color. We know this in particular because despite the Shelby County decision, we still have some legal protections. And it was the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in 2016 that said, when H589 was written, it targeted African Americans with almost surgical precision. That's a direct quote. Now, they came to that conclusion because in function what they were doing was they were looking at how to make this law. And they saw, okay, here are the people who have IDs. Here are the people who don't. Here are the people who use this week of early voting. Here are the people who don't. And they tailored the law to select their voters. Now, it's supposed to be that voters elect their representatives, not the other way around. And what H589 was doing was exactly that. And by intentionally discriminating against people of color, they broke the law. But it was only one piece of a bigger story. Because we also have in North Carolina some of the most gerrymandered maps in the country. Now, I figure if you're in this room or watching, you have some broad idea about what gerrymandering is. It is the idea that when you draw your maps for your representatives, Congress, your state legislature, your judges, depending on the state you live in, You draw them in such a way to advantage certain people, certain voters over others. And so when I talk about elected officials choosing their voters and not the other way, that is literally what was happening with gerrymandering North Carolina. North Carolina's maps for both Congress and its own state legislature were held by courts to be unlawful racial gerrymanders. And this year, at the beginning of 2018, one set of those maps was also held to be an unlawful partisan gerrymander. Because one excuse that we have heard in recent years, and not just in North Carolina, was that, well, yes, okay, we are trying to draw these lines so that it is more difficult for African Americans to elect their candidates of choice, but really we're just doing that because they don't vote with us. So we're discriminating against their political party, not against their race. There are lots of ways in which this works, but one technique is called packing and cracking. So the law sets certain requirements for the way in which districts have to be drawn. They have to be about the same size. Minority candidates have to have the ability to choose their candidates of choice under the law. But what can happen is that they may draw the lines so that there is a very high concentration of certain voters in one place so that they aren't affecting elections in other districts. Or there may be an area with a high concentration of voters somewhere that are split up so that their voices are diluted in the districts the way that they're drawn. And these are things that often happen behind closed doors we've seen in North Carolina. But people have fought back. People have sued. People have gone to our state legislature. Just yesterday in Raleigh, the Poor People's Campaign was there, and people were performing their acts of civil disobedience. This work goes on. How does it tie into everything else? In this way. Because in North Carolina, the extreme agenda doesn't apply only to voting. It applies to healthcare. It applies to education. 20,000 teachers marched on Raleigh last week for higher wages. It applies to every issue that you care about. And what we believe is that no matter what issue it is that you care about, you have to care about our democracy. You have to care about voting, you have to care about redistricting, and you have to care about the role of money in our politics, because that is a piece of it too. Until we can get to a point where you don't have to be a millionaire to run for office, we're going to be pushing back against these things. And in North Carolina, we're at the forefront. It's where all the bad ideas have been brought to be tested, and because of folks like you, folks watching, and folks that I get to work with, it's where these bad ideas are also going to die. So thank you for your time. And Penda, I'm glad to hand it over to the next panelist.
Thank you. Thank you, Tomas. I'd now like to introduce Ashley Allison, who is senior advisor at the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights and acting executive vice president for FIELD. And Allison is going to bring us the view from the Hill. The Leadership Conference is the premier civil rights coalition that deals with the federal government, the Congress, the White House, the Supreme Court, and it, I believe, has more than 200 national organizations that represent the Fusion Coalition, whether it's labor, women, people of color, environmentalists. They bring the Fusion Coalition to the Hill. All right. And prior to joining the Leadership Conference, Ashley worked in the White House, the Obama White House. Just to be clear, as Deputy Director and Senior Policy Advisor under Valerie Jarrett in the White House Office of Public Engagement, and she managed a team that worked with the LGBTQ, Muslim, faith, African American, disability, and entertainment communities. And she is a graduate of Ohio State University. And she earned her JD from Brooklyn Law School. She earned a Master's of Education from Long Island University, and she did that while also working as a high school special education teacher in Brooklyn. Thank you. Thank you for being with us, Allison.
Well, good evening. Thank you for having me. I'm going to talk a little bit on the Hill, but the sister who spoke earlier, I'm going to hopefully connect with you as a Black female millennial also, because I think we are in a very, very important moment if we don't have young millennials of color who are coming to the forefront and actually engaging in the democratic process. This third era of Reconstruction, I'm not sure we will find it, but I'm hopeful that we will, because I believe we will step up to the plate. So, you know, it's 2018. We live in D.C. We know, and this is a midterm election. You will see ads if you go to many states about political candidates. They will run regularly. If you turn on any national news channel, there will be constant conversation about the election. And then, you know, in 2 years, there'll be 2020, as we just, you know, kind of got over the aftermath of 2016 and what we're still living in it. And then 2020 will come, and there'll be a presidential, and you'll kind of get that same wave. And simultaneously, in years like 2018 and 2020, when you see this constant influx of political ads, there's also a story that happens every year during every election, and it's surrounded, and the underpinnings of it are around voter suppression. Yes. You see stories of long lines, and most of the people who are waiting in line often are people of color or poor people. You see people like in North Carolina who, when they go to the wrong polling place, get no guidance as to where to go to the right one, even if the person knows where to go or if how they can find the information. You have students who are turned away because they don't have the right voter ID, or they're told they need voter ID and they really don't. And you ask yourself, why is it so hard? I'm from Ohio. I know it's hard because my first election that I voted in was in 2000, and I was a student. I did not have a car as a freshman. And I had to travel 3 miles off campus in a path that was not bike-friendly. There are not a lot of bike-friendly places in the 2000s in Ohio, to just go vote. Fast forward 4 years later, when I wanted to vote in 2004, I always have felt this connection to the democratic process and wanted to express my vote, but I had to wait in that election for 3 hours in the pouring rain, like the rain that was happening a couple hours ago here in D.C. that has been going on for 8 days straight in D.C., I had to wait in the cold rain for 3 hours outside to cast my vote. So you ask yourself, if someone is poor, if someone has an hourly wage job, if someone has a boss who doesn't want to empower them to engage in the voting process, how do they engage? How do they get to vote? And so why is it so hard? You know, you hear about our organization was one of the leading organizations that was a part of writing the Voting Rights Act. And so as I study our organization's history, we think about poll taxes and we think about literacy tests, and we are told to believe that that was a past era, that civil rights was an era where you don't need to really think about it anymore. It's like something that was happening as though when black men and black women are killed in the streets, like that's not a civil rights issue that is happening right here today in our country. But so you ask yourself why generation after generation, decade after decade, movement after movement, why it is so hard to vote. And it goes a lot back to what Reverend Barbara was talking about, is this power, right? The vote is our power. And until we know our inherent power is sitting in that individual opportunity, that fission coalition that we can all come together, we have people who want to take our power. They want to take our divine power. They want people to think that the same fear an African-American person feels as they're driving down the street and are pulled over by a police officer is not the same fear that an immigrant person feels when they hear a knock on the door and they don't know it's ICE. Once people can connect those dots and know that fear, that's the fear they want to take, and they don't want to empower people to have that vote. Now, they can take our vote, our power that way, but we can also give it up by not voting. And we'll talk a little bit about that, but we aren't going to do that anymore. And Tomas talked a little bit about this, but in 2013, it got a lot harder or a lot easier for people who wanted to take the vote, our power away, through Shelby County v. Holder, a Supreme Court case. And he summed it up pretty nice. I don't really need to go into much more detail, but I'll just say one of the most appalling things, despite all the data points that we learned in 2006, when there was a reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act, and there was data point after data point, fact after fact, the discrimination was still happening in our voting process. The Supreme Court, one of the most appalling rationales in the opinion of why they did not want certain jurisdictions to have to go seek this clearance, this pre-clearance for making any decision on how they implement, was that they said there were 40-year-old facts with no logical relation to why these jurisdictions still needed to seek pre-clearance. Now, if you did this quick math when I first started, I said I voted in my first election when I was 18 in 2000. That means I'm 35. That means I'm not even at 40. And I'm telling you of real-life data experiences where I have experienced challenges in voting. I'm sure many of you can either say from firsthand experience or from someone one or two steps removed of the challenges that we face. So the court just got it wrong. And to think that this is not all connected, I just want to zoom out for a second. So we are an organization that we definitely focus a lot in the Beltway, but we also know the connection points between what happens in local and state elections. So in this midterm election, many people on Capitol Hill that are supposed to be elected to represent us are up for re-election. And currently, one of their responsibilities in the Senate in particular is to confirm lifetime judicial nominations. These are the people who decide cases like Shelby. They sit on the bench, they make decisions, not just in the Supreme Court, on the local federal courts too. And they're lifetime nominations. I am not here to fight for the Democrats or the Republicans, I'm here to fight for justice. And under President Trump's administration, there are 39 new lifetime judicial nominations that have been confirmed already. Those people who have been confirmed, they want Shelby on steroids. If we do not elect people in 2018 that can stop folks and who will stand up and at least ask a question about what you think on the Voting Rights Act, I don't know what to say. I'll pivot off of one just to give you some perspective on how terrible some of these nominees are. Last week was the anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education. And one of the nominees, Vitter, when asked if they thought that decision by the Supreme Court was made correctly, she would not answer in the affirmative. So the Senate paused on confirming her, and we'll take it up next week. Imagine if she gets a lifetime appointment. Imagine when a voting case comes up in her circuit. But luckily, we have organizations like the Brennan Center, like the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, like ACLU, like Advancement Projects, that know that there are some provisions still that they can fight back to protect, to stop voter suppression. And we do that in litigation. But the unfortunate part of that is that many people who are disenfranchised, they don't have the resources always to seek counsel. If anyone has ever worked for a nonprofit, you know we are never resourced enough to defend all the injustices of the world. So we're also up against that. We're up against money in politics, people who just want to pay to keep us down. But we're fighting through litigation, and we're winning many cases day by day. There are some states that are also seeking affirmative solutions. And they're doing things like automatic voter registration, or online voter registration, or early voting, like my state, Ohio. But the challenge with issues like Shelby is that while some state legislatures and governors want to do the right thing, some do not, like in the state of North Carolina. There are groups like the Lawyers Committee and Access Democracy that work on day of issues during the election process, on election protection and voter protection, and also work right now with election administrators who are trying to do the right thing but are under-resourced and can't get the proper funding from Congress or from the state legislatures to protect the right to vote. But I don't want to paint this like doom and gloom scenario. There are some things that we're doing that are working. And I know my sister Barbara will talk a little bit about some of the voter enfranchisement work, but just this past year, the Trump administration established something called the Pence Kobach Commission. You might not know about it because it doesn't exist, because we fought to get it dismantled. But it was established under a false narrative that voting fraud is real, which is just not accurate. And with the fusion coalition of state and local and civil rights groups and environmental groups and women reproductive rights groups and a coalition of folks, we fought to dismantle it and say, not on our watch. We also have people who, even though they have served their time, don't have the right to vote. And we have them also in Florida leading the fight, our brother Desmond Meade, to ensure that formerly incarcerated individuals also get their right back to vote. So I'll be brief in my conclusion, but they know our power. Reverend Barber said it better than anyone else. They know our power, and they want to take our power. But we will not give it to them. We will not allow their voter suppression tactics to work. We will not be intimidated. We will not let the 2.2 million individuals in this country that are incarcerated in federal and state prison go forgotten. We will not let the 800,000 dreamers that now have to live in fear because of this administration be alone. And we can do that even if you don't know someone who is incarcerated, even if you don't know someone who is a dreamer, by activating your networks to vote. And we're seeing this now like never before. The intersection points, when we march for our lives, when we say Me Too, when we wear pink pussy hats and come take to the streets in the Women's March, when we say Black Lives Matter, we will take our power. They cannot have it. We will protect our right to vote. We will fight to vote, and we will vote. Thank you.
Thank you, Ashley. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Barbara R. Arnwine. Barbara and I have worked together so many years. I think it goes back to maybe the Reagan administration. Barbara is president and founder of Transformative Justice Coalition. Gotta love that name. She is internationally renowned for contributions on critical justice issues, including the passage of the landmark Civil Rights Act of 1991. And the 2006 reauthorization of provisions of the Voting Rights Act. And her work includes women's rights, immigrant rights, judicial diversity, criminal justice reform, racial profiling, healthcare disparities, and LGBTQ rights. She's a prominent leader in the civil and human rights community, and she continues to fight for affirmative action. Barbara is a graduate of Scripps College and Duke University School of Law. Thank Welcome, you. Barbara.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, President. Thank you so much. Thank you. What an evening. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
What a pleasure it is to be here in the shadow of the prophet, our prophet, Reverend William Barber. You have done just an amazing job. And in fact, Reverend Rodney Sadler, I asked him yesterday, I said, Reverend Sadler, what do I need to say tomorrow? He says, start off by reminding people of something that Dr. Barber said so beautifully, that the fight for voting rights is part of our fight for our spiritual inheritance.
All right.
That is part of our humanity. That, you know, we have to make sure that when everybody talks about that, it is our spiritual inheritance to have the right to vote. So we have to, you know, really remember that. You know, in 2011, when I created the infamous map of shame with my son, and started talking about voter suppression, what did people tell me? You crazy. You know, hush, sit down, you're playing the race card, don't talk about this. But thank God that we persisted, that we weren't to be shut up or silenced, because our ancestors weren't that way. And everything that we know as justice has come out from the cries in the wilderness when people bring justice to the forefront. So in 2018, what is our realities? That, you know, the panelists have all laid out so much good information. I hope that everyone will take it to heart and really keep, you know, spreading the word, keep educating others. What we've been working on is two things I'm going to talk about briefly. One is that we created a National Commission for Voter Justice. Some 20 plus organizations have come together and have created this commission that's going around the country, holding hearings, researching, documenting, and educating about the massive impact of voter suppression and electoral irregularities in the United States. We're also advocating for voter reform, the end of voter suppression laws, and for other progressive, active, great advances in our democracy. We just launched this year. We've already have had, you know, two major hearings covering Michigan, Georgia, South Carolina, and we're about to, on June 2nd, have a hearing in Miami, Florida. And some of you may have seen the flyer that we have produced for the Miami hearing. I know there are extra copies of the flyer here in the room. And we are hoping that people in Florida will come and be part of this great hearing. I also want to say, there's one statistic that nobody talks about from 2016. If you've heard it, raise your hand. In 2016, there were 2 million less African American ballots counted. Counted. 2 million less than in 2012. An 11% decrease in African American ballots counted. Every political scientist had said that there would be a 6% increase based on population gain. Instead, it was an 11% reversal, the first time since the enactment of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. A decrease. What accounted for that? It wasn't just turnout. It was also voter suppression. So when you look at the numbers out of 2016, remember a couple of things, because this is about the work we got to do today. That one of the reasons why you saw that decline was because of the use of voter ID. In Wisconsin, a new study out this year shows that 200,000 voters were discouraged from voting in Wisconsin. You know how close that state's decision was. And when we had the hearing in Michigan, we had the testimony about the 75,000 ballots that were not counted for president. 75,000 ballots that were cast but not counted in the Detroit area. These in another state that was this close in the ballot, in the balloting. We have the University of California at San Diego has done an amazing study from October 2017 looking at the impact of voter ID laws. So we know that that's a problem. But one thing we heard at the hearing in Michigan that I did not expect to hear was how many homeless people, especially black homeless youth, weren't able to vote. Because people don't think about that. 39% of all homeless in this country are black. People don't think about the fact that the largest growing segment of homeless in our country are youth. Young people, 20% is estimated, of college students are homeless. We don't think about the, when we're talking about the Poor People's Campaign, this intersection of homelessness and the vote is key. And we need to understand that this is part of the reason why we have to fight against poverty. It's what part of the reason why we have to make sure. So when you think about it, these are some of the problems. We also have heard in Georgia from elderly folks on the other side who weren't born in hospitals, who weren't able to vote. We have also seen a new stat that came out this year, should not surprise anybody. In 2018, there was another statistic that came out showing that 60%, and some people say it's higher, it's closer to 80%, but 60% documented of all polling sites are inaccessible if you are a person with a disability. 60%, think about that. Two-thirds chance that you're going to go to vote and there's no accessibility, no machine that you can operate that will help you to vote. No curbside voting to avoid these obstacles, all of these problems. How many people do you think that affected? We know that in 2016, based on stats, statistical data and studies, that 3 million people with disabilities were unable to vote. Now, we're talking about an election that was decided by 60,000 votes. I want us to, you know, really start putting all this into perspective. You know, today I was, before I came here, you know, I'm very active on Twitter at Barb73. Get into all kind of trouble. But Shada Keen and I were talking about Aaron Schlossberg. And about, you know, the guy from, you know, from New York City who decided he's going to, you know, get all into people's faces because they were speaking Spanish. So he's quote issued an apology that is sad, so weak and ugly. So anyway, so I talked about how weak it was. And somebody actually went on Twitter and said, she's a disgrace because she's disabled. And she eats at the public throng by getting our public assistance money and doesn't pay taxes. Now, isn't it interesting? They didn't attack me on my race or my gender. They made up a lie and based it on poverty and disability. Think about that. That's what's happening to the mentality of our country. And it's a dangerous thing. You know, I could talk too long, so I'm going to start, you know, winding up real fast, Penda. I'm not here forever, you know. But the other thing that people haven't focused on is in 2017, post the election, what happened in Georgia when we did the Georgia hearings? Were you aware that in late 2017, that the state of Georgia purged 700,000 voters? Whew. There was a lawsuit brought to address that, and guess what they did in the state of Georgia? You know, trying to get rid of the lawsuit, they immediately restored almost 350,000 votes. Think about the arbitrariness of that.
Right. Right.
the absolute viciousness of that. I call that the ethnic cleansing of the vote. All of these purging efforts all over the country that we're seeing. We have also seen, you know, unprocessed registrations by the hundreds of thousands of voters in various states. We've seen NVRA noncompliance. We've seen exact name match exclusions. Did you know that if you're in South Carolina, if you're in Florida, if you go to vote and you present an identification that is not an exact match, that is, you cannot vote, that you're given a provisional ballot. And you got to return to show that provisional, that you actually could produce some exact match ID. We talked about many other things, but here's what I want to say. Going forward, you know, join the National Commission for Voter Justice as we move around the country, as we have our hearings around the country. Join us. You can go to nationalcvj.org and be part of that. And be part of that initiative, because we got a hearing coming up, as I mentioned, in Florida. We got one on July 14th in Southern California, in Los Angeles. One on July 21st in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. September, we're going to be in Arizona and Texas. We need you to be part of this work. Last comment. 73 million. 73 million. That's the number of millennials who are eligible to vote in this country. 73 million. It is the largest voting cohort in the country. If millennials were able to vote at the same, when I say millennials, I'm including Generation Z, if they voted at their numbers, this country changes totally. Because every sociological study of millennials show they're totally, for the most part, totally different than those who have been voting so conservative. So what we've been doing is training millennials to be leaders in the vote. You know, you want to talk about where's the hope in the future. There's a lot of hope in the future. Amazing leaders. They've been going out and registering people, educating, holding forums, doing all of this. We call that the Millennial Votes Matters, you know, trainings, and we're going to train some 300 young people to provide direct assistance to vulnerable voters. And when we talk about direct assistance, we're talking about voter education, voter registration, voter mobilization, voter turnout, and voter protection. Those are the things that we need desperately, because everything I mentioned that has been a problem, all these things that President Trump bragged about the decrease in the number of black voters, of ballots counted, everything that we've talked about can be addressed if we do the right ground game, the right organization in the states, the right commitment. Never forget, I always say, vote like a black woman. I always say, vote like a black woman. Don't forget, you can find out more about the Millennial Votes Matters at tjcoalition.org. We are not to be denied. This is our time. Let's do it. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you, Barbara, and thank you to Tomas, Ashley, and Barbara. Okay. So I'll just close out really quickly. This has been such a wonderful teach-in. We've learned so much. Our teachers have been fantastic. And so I just want to say that in 1957, Dr. King said, he gave a speech and was called Give Us the Ballot.
Yes.
And he said, give us the ballot and we will give you legislators of goodwill. And when you, then a decade later, a little less than a decade later, the Voting Rights Act was enacted. And the path toward getting the ballot opened up, getting access, had begun. And it had begun because of activists in Selma and other places that stood up and marched and walked into police lines and submitted their bodies to beatings and other types of abuse. And I like to think that 3 years later, when Dr. King began to conceive of the Poor People's Campaign, that he said to himself, we've got the vote now, let's go do something with it that's revolutionary. Let's address poverty and economic justice. And this campaign, Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, has picked up that mantle and is using the vote and is using the tools of protest and advocacy and organizing to address poverty and to address racism, to address ecological devastation, and to bring about the beloved community. So thank you all for being here.
Thank you all. As I said, I came today to learn. And I definitely learned a lot today and was very open to understanding, you know, I don't vote, but I learned today a lot of why people in my community don't feel comfortable voting, all the obstacles that was purposely put in our way so that we feel, dang, we shouldn't even go vote today because it doesn't even matter. But today, we're going to be working through those things. And I would like to welcome everyone to go to the Poor People's Campaign's website, poorpeoplescampaign.org, and check out our demands specifically around this area, and I'll read those off today. We demand the immediate full restoration and expansion of the Voting Rights Act, an end to racist gerrymandering and redistricting early registration of 17 and 18-year-olds, the implementation of automatic registration to vote at the age of 18. Early voting in every state. Same date registration. The enactment of Election Day as a holiday. And a verifiable paper record. We demand the right to vote for the formerly incarcerated. We demand the reversal of state laws preempting local governments from passing minimum wage increases and the removal of emergency financial management positions that are unaccountable to the democratic process. We demand an end to placing persons on the federal branch, on the federal bench, who have a record of standing against voting rights. We demand statehood, voting rights, and representation for the more than 690,000 people in Washington, D.C. We demand a clear and just immigration system that strengthens our democracy through the broad participation of everyone in this country. This includes providing a timely citizenship process that guarantees the right to vote. It also requires protecting immigrants' abilities to organize for their rights in the workplace and in their communities without fear of retribution, detention, and deportation. Furthermore, we demand that First Nations, Native Americans, and Alaskan Native people retain their tribal recognition as nations, not races, to make substantive claims to their sovereignty. Thank you so much for today. Go on the campaign's website, see how to get involved. Go to figure out if you want to do more teach-ins and want to participate in live sessions. Sign up there, poorpeoplescampaign.org. Thank you all so much again.
Everybody's got a right to live. Everybody's got a right to live. And before this campaign fails, we'll all go down to jail. Everybody's got a right to live. got a right to vote.
To vote.
Everybody's got a right to live.
Conversation after this, so please feel free to stay, get some more ice cream, because I know that's what y'all really came here for, the Ben and Jerry's. But yeah, we'll be talking soon.